Hello, and again, welcome to Bit Depth. I am Santiago Ramones. Across from me is George Lang.
How's it going?
It's pretty good. We got a sudden surge of cold to make the last bit of February to feel like February.
It's ridiculous. Living in Oklahoma, you're just like completely being, you know, around this time of year, you're just being pulled back and forth. It's like yesterday, you know, me and my son were like, we're riding bikes through the neighborhood. Everything just, it just feels like late spring.
Yeah.
And, you know, life is beautiful. And then they put the hammer down on you.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, you know, something like climate change or something, but that's not real.
No, never.
All right. So to start with, what do you do?
Oh man, I do a lot of stuff. Okay, so I, you know, first of all, I'm a journalist. I've been a journalist for over 20 years. I started out with the Oklahoma Gazette here in Oklahoma City, and then I was there for a few years. I went to the Oklahoman.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there for a couple more years, went back to the Gazette,
mm-hmm.
spent three more years there, went back to the Oklahoma, spent a decade there. And, you know, and so in early 2014, I left the Oklahoman and went into PR, went to work for a local PR firm for a couple of years. And then in late 2015, I started my own gig.
Mm-hmm.
And so I run Language PR, which is, PR for local musicians,
yeah.
some nonprofits, some small businesses, things like that.
Yeah.
Things that I really, people
yeah.
I like to work with.
Yeah.
So in addition to that, I'm still doing some journalism for the Gazette. I also host a show called Spy 101
mm-hmm.
on The Spy at 8 o'clock on Saturdays. Little plug. I kind of run that like
a
classroom.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm doing is I will take one topic, whether it's a band or an incident that happened in music or a genre,
mm-hmm.
and I will just kind of give a class
mm-hmm.
on it. Talk a little bit about the facts surrounding a particular artist, and then play, you know, a lot of the music that they've done, and then maybe some of the people that they influenced,
yeah.
Some choice covers of
mm-hmm.
of that group, things like that.
Yeah.
So I do that, and then I'm also a teacher.
Yeah.
I teach at ACM at UCO. I've been teaching the digital media class
yeah.
for three semesters now, and this semester, I started teaching music business nonfiction,
yeah.
which is kind of a blast too, because you're able to kind of like explore some of the, you know,
yeah.
like the stories that surround some of the music that
mm.
you know is kind of part of our history,
yeah.
And learn a lot about how the music business kind of came to be.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a blast. And toward the end, we actually explore some of the recent trends
yeah.
In the music business, particularly surrounding Top 40.
Mm-hmm.
So
cool.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. So to go all the way back, what made you want to do journalism?
Okay. Well, I when I was a kid, I've always been kind of a music nerd.
Mm-hmm.
And so so really, journalism, I think, kind of came out of that. One of the things that I remember most clearly from my childhood is spending a lot of time lying on the bed, listening to music, having the album with all of the credits and liner
yeah.
notes and all that stuff right in front of me. And then at the same time, I discovered in my early teens Rolling Stone magazine, which was a really cool thing once upon a time.
Yeah.
I mean, like it was like, you know, the best music journalism
mm-hmm.
that you could readily get
yeah.
when you're a kid in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yeah.
So, so I would read those cover to cover, and I would look at liner notes, and I would study all of the people who were involved in recordings. And for me, it was kind of revelatory to discover in Rolling Stone serious analysis of, you know, of the music that I cared about. And when I would listen to music, I would start to formulate my analysis based on the way that, you know, like these people like Dave Marsh and Park Puterbaugh and Kurt Loder and all of these people were writing about it. So I started thinking the way they wrote. And I wanted to do it too. So I started, I took a journalism class in high school, you know, introduction to journalism. And the first thing that I was asked to write, I was supposed to just write a, like, a fake news story, news, right? You know? And so I was just supposed to kind of use the news format. And so I wrote it like a Rolling Stone piece. And I got a big F. She flunked me hard on that on that first thing because I wasn't using the inverted pyramid form of writing a news story. You know, where you start with the big point and then you work your way down to the details. And so, so I learned very quickly how to do that.
To do the right
thing as far as journalism goes. And I became the entertainment editor for my high school newspaper, which was the Trojan Torch there at Jinx, Oklahoma. It just sort of stuck with me. I mean, right after high school, I went into the military. I was an intelligence specialist in the Navy, and so for a long time there, I took a significant break from really writing anything. But as soon as I got out and I enrolled at OU, I immediately caught the bug again, and so I went to work for the OU Daily down at OU pretty quickly. Started writing reviews and things like that. Got on staff I think my second semester there, and so I did when I was there. I wrote like every possible kind of story that I could write. I wrote hard news stories. I did entertainment writing. Feature writing. I was the features editor. I was the night editor. I just kind of like covered it all. And not long after school was finished, I went to work for the Gazette. And I was just like, for me, I was always going to be a writer. I don't think there was any question that that's what I was going to do. But getting into newspaper was really the best possible way to do it. It kind of fit my style of writing.
Did you always stick to entertainment, or did you continue to just move around in the Gazette?
I wanted to write entertainment, but like my editor, a guy named Mike Easterling, he really wanted his writers to do everything. So, I mean, I'm not a sporto, but he had me like doing profiles of athletes, going and interviewing athletes. And I covered murder cases. I covered the Oklahoma City bombing. I spent several weeks down there at the site covering what was going on there. And for several months after that, I was writing stories. That surrounded the Oklahoma City bombing in some way. And so, it was really only after, probably after like a year or so of being on staff that I actually got to write about entertainment stories on an ongoing basis, writing record reviews and and doing profiles of musicians who were coming through and playing dates.
Do you think that it's better for like a publication to have writers that specialize in certain things, or do you sort of align yourself with the everyone doing everything sort of view?
Well, I don't know. I feel like I benefited from it.
Sure.
And the reason why I benefited is because I had a kind of a foundation in hard news that allowed me to take feature stories seriously.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of people think that feature stories, especially like people who like do nothing but cover like serious hard news, life and death kind of stuff, they think of entertainment as being completely frivolous.
Sure.
Like, you're just bullshitting around with with these musicians, and you're rewriting press releases, and you really have it easy or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's never like that.
Yeah.
It can be, but I don't really feel like people who do that kind of journalism last very long.
Right? Yeah.
If you feel like there's a serious story to be told,
mm-hmm.
you know, then you'll go after it. You'll go after that interview with, you know, with Tom Hanks or with whichever star that you're mm-hmm. interviewing, with the seriousness that you would apply to a double murder.
Yeah.
You know,
How do you think, obviously there's like this whole fake news, stupid sort of thing, but like there is some honesty to saying that the news and journalism has gotten, if not dishonest, at least biased over time.
I think that's probably true. Look, what happened is everybody ended up in their own camps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have we can go into sort of like the roots of what happened, where like back in the late 1980s, Ronald Reagan repealed the Fairness Doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the Fairness Doctrine was what kept like radio stations from like overemphasizing one point of view.
Sure.
They were giving equal time to everybody. Well, when the Fairness Doctrine goes out the window
mm-hmm.
in 1987, then the following year is when Rush Limbaugh went nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And really when you don't have to sort of like walk down the middle all the time, then you end up with these sort of factional news phenomena, like Fox News becomes sort of the mouthpiece for the right when it comes on comes on the air in 1996,
mm-hmm.
and so you end up with like everybody's got their selective version of the media that they can go with now, their selective version of the truth. And that's, and really it's just been fairly recently that we get into this like worst case scenario of all that, which is the fake news situation.
Sure.
And that's, they've kind of proven that, that fake news stories had greater readership during the 2016 election than real news stories,
mm-hmm.
at least on Facebook.
Sure.
Okay. So I think that's kind of how, that whole thing happens. And, and honestly, I don't know what the answer is other than maybe going back and reinstating the Fairness Doctrine.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the weird and wordy and technical answer to your question.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's kind of where we're at now. Mm-hmm. Is like, you know, what do we do to kind of rectify a pretty shitty situation?
Right? Yeah. Do you think there's a possibility of the writers themselves choosing to just write the facts as opposed to adding, you know, hey, this is bad, or hey, this is good?
Okay, so you're talking about like partisan writing, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't know if you can put that genie back in the bottle. I mean, at this mm-hmm. point, unless you have like specific legislation that would, you know, that would create, you know, a new fairness doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's always been opinion.
Sure.
But at this stage now, you have, you know, the, you know, there's kind of, there's a market imperative
mm-hmm.
for this to actually exist.
Yeah.
I mean, would anybody really watch Fox News if they weren't just shouting opinions all the time? You know, and the same goes to some degree to MSNBC.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people show up to those particular parties
mm-hmm.
because they know that, you know, that somebody's going to say something that they agree with.
Yeah.
Or somebody's going to kind of give them that adrenaline rush of being really angry.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you break from that and you go back to news being a public service?
Sure.
Which is what it kind of started with.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's... The news business itself is a market driven phenomenon right
yeah.
now. That happened when the you know, when news sort of became conglomerated
yeah.
and corporatized. You know, if you look at, like, you know, back in the day, you know, Walter Cronkite era of
mm-hmm.
TV news. Back then, CBS, which, you know, they didn't require the news to make a profit.
Yeah.
It's like, we don't care if you're making money or not.
Yeah.
This is part of the public trust.
Mm-hmm.
But that changed
yeah.
when, you know, CBS gets, you know, gets bought a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ultimately now it's owned by Viacom, which, you know, and they want the CBS Evening News to move a lot of commercials for Dulcolax and Cialis and whatever else, you know, people who watch the evening news are going to buy.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's you know, that's part of the problem right there.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, and why it's so important for, you know, there to be, I don't know, just like the last shreds of independent news,
yeah.
Where it's all about news gathering. Like, you know, you have groups like, you know, the nonprofit ProPublica.
Mm-hmm.
They were established by a former Wall Street Journal executive
mm-hmm.
Who, you know, really felt that there needed to be, as you know, as like newspapers were going through their upheaval,
yeah,
there needed to be something where there wasn't a profit motive and
yeah.
you could just like devote some like serious news gathering to subjects that really matter.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So, yeah. I mean, I feel like it's, you know, it's awfully hard at this point
mm-hmm.
when there are market forces that are driving it.
Yeah.
You know. So.
And have you experienced anything that you like didn't want to write the opinion that your editor wanted to, for example?
Yeah. Well. Okay, well, there was one time when I was writing a well,
You don't have to name names.
I'm not going to name names. But there was a local sort of hero who had starred in a film here.
Mm.
And it wasn't a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some internal pressures as well as some external ones,
mm-hmm.
to not go after this film as hard as it deserved.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's one of my great regrets,
mm-hmm.
that I didn't lie about anything.
Sure.
But I didn't go as hard on it as I should.
Yeah.
Have, right. And that's kind of the danger when you have, when you have media outlets that, you know, might have, other interests,
mm-hmm.
that they want to take care of.
Yeah.
So sometimes that happens.
Yeah.
And that's why, if we could somehow tap into that feeling of total independence and,
mm-hmm.
being able to pursue stories,
yeah.
regardless of the potential economic implications,
mm-hmm.
that is a really good,
yeah, thing. Yeah. Is that partly why you sort of like stepped away and became sort of started your own thing?
Not entirely, but you do see where things are going,
mm-hmm.
and with the, with full-time journalism is very hard work.
Yeah.
And I respect the people who are still doing it.
Sure.
But I think I had just, I think everything had sort of reached critical mass. I had done what I felt was like everything that I could possibly do in my capacity,
yeah.
as a full-time journalist at that point. And I was really looking to try something new.
Yeah.
The pressures of, like when you have, reductions in force and things like that. I mean,
mm-hmm.
because, really the news does not go away. It's,
yeah.
like, it's like delivering the mail.
Yeah.
Or whatever. It never stops.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so people who work in journalism are working harder now than they have ever worked before.
Yeah.
And frankly, I was exhausted.
Yeah.
And so I really wanted to try something new. And,
mm-hmm.
PR was out there as a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tried it out. And it really turned out to be a very cool,
yeah.
thing, especially now when I get to, represent musicians that I really like.
Exactly.
So in many ways I'm using the same skills,
mm-hmm.
that I used as an entertainment reporter. It's just kind of like directed differently.
Yeah. How is it different, and then how is it better?
Well, it's okay. I don't know that PR is necessarily better.
Mm-hmm.
It's just serving a different master in a way.
Sure.
So, like, when you're doing PR, it's pure advocacy.
Yeah.
Okay. and you're working for a client. Somebody is paying you to to put their story out there,
mm-hmm.
and also really to put it out there in the best light.
Yeah.
Now with journalism, it's more of a warts and all kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
You're writing about a story with both, both the positive and the negative aspects,
yeah.
built into it. I'm trying to think of a good example, but I was in a press conference.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'll give you a direct example. I was in a press conference situation for a movie called The Lake House,
mm-hmm.
with Sandra Bullock,
mm-hmm.
and Keanu Reeves. And Reeves can be a really good interview subject,
mm-hmm.
But on this day he was not. He was not into it at all. In fact, he at one point he like got out of his chair and laid down on the floor of this like meeting room in this hotel.
Sure.
And he's like looking at the baseboards or something, like, you know, I don't know what was going on
yeah.
with the guy, but he was not engaged with things.
Sure.
And I just decided to write it as it was.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to, a lot of people didn't necessarily who I was there with that day didn't necessarily say anything about it, but
yeah.
I was there and I was being a professional,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and on that particular day he wasn't.
Sure.
Okay. You know, now like, you know, like every, to this day, every single time I see Keanu Reeves on a talk show, I'm watching him more than anybody else to see what his demeanor is going to be like, if he's going to be paying attention or if his eyes are just going to be wandering around and looking
sure.
and looking around the room and
yeah.
trying to find something more interesting than Jimmy Fallon or or Trevor Noah or whoever. Because,
yeah.
I really did feel like, you know, when that happened, I felt like telling the story. And telling it exactly how it went.
Yeah.
There was another one that was kind of like that, but it was the opposite
mm-hmm.
kind of deal where there was a journalist in the room who was not being as professional as they should have been.
Sure.
This was it was an interview. Okay. Like Billy Bob Thornton was in this remake of The Bad News Bears
mm-hmm.
that Richard Linklater directed.
Yeah.
Wasn't a great remake, but anyway, it came out during the time that and this is a long time ago, but it was
mm-hmm.
but he was at the time he was with Angelina Jolie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it was during that time that, or he had just broken up with her, or
mm-hmm.
she had just broken up with him, or whatever. And it was, you know, they had like, I don't know if you remember, but like for a while there, they were wearing like
each other's blood
in
their neck or something,
like
yeah.
lockets or something,
yeah.
You know, around their necks. And so this reporter from a sort of like, a celebrity magazine
sure.
Got up and started, you know, trying to get him to talk about,
mm.
you know, like blood pendants and
sure.
Angelina Jolie and all of this. And so like, I'm trying to think of exactly what Billy Bob said. He let this reporter ask the full question about
mm-hmm.
Angelina Jolie and the blood and all that. And then he said, well, when I first signed on to the Bad News Bears,
exactly.
you know, Richard Linklater told me exactly what he wanted to do. And he's, you know, he starts like giving this answer that has nothing to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was awesome. And everybody was like laughing their ass off
yeah.
as this reporter was just like was standing there and had this, you know, sheepish look on their face about
mm-hmm.
like having asked a stupid and irrelevant question.
Exactly.
I wrote about it as it happened,
exactly.
and people liked it a lot.
Yeah,
it was a real blast. So, telling the truth is a lot more interesting as far as that kind of thing goes. But with PR, on the other hand, you're really just trying. You're using sort of the same muscles,
mm-hmm.
but you're kind of. But you're directing it toward a goal, which is to get attention for your client.
Yeah.
To tell their story, to provide the basis for somebody else to write
mm-hmm.
a story or do an interview or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you're just serving a different master.
Yeah.
That's a really rambling answer.
No, that's fine.
Damn.
I enjoy rambling answers. And I mean, because I feel like there's this perception of, like, the PR guy, like, sitting in the room being like, you can't say that, or...
Yeah. You know, I've never really had to do that. Generally, most of my clients are pretty savvy.
Sure.
I do some media training.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, getting somebody prepared to be in contact with the media, because there is a skill involved in that.
Yeah.
And so there's, yeah, it's not like being an attorney.
Sure.
Where you know, you're like whispering. That was me pantomiming whispering. But yeah, so it's not exactly like that. But like, if I were to have a client who kind of, like, you know, went off the reservation a little bit,
mm-hmm.
with an interview, I would just talk to them about that, and then
mm-hmm.
maybe I would call the reporter and provide some sort of clarification.
Yeah,
that kind of thing.
Sure.
So, you know, it's an interesting business.
Yeah,
but. Yeah, you just, you know, it never looks like the McCarthy hearings,
sure.
or something.
Yeah. As usual, I'm not good at transitioning to the second half of the podcast, so I'll just ask the question anyways. what do you believe as far as religion goes?
Wow. Okay, so... religion's been an interesting thing for me. I didn't really grow up in
mm-hmm.
religion necessarily. I just remember being in sixth grade and my parents suggesting, you know what you should do? You should go to church. And I was like, well, maybe you should go to church. They didn't go to church.
Yeah.
But they were suggesting that me and my brother do it. I don't know. Maybe they just wanted us out of the house on Sunday morning. But I was, I did go to church. I went to a Methodist church, which
mm-hmm.
is, you know, kind of like, you know, a little easygoing.
Mm-hmm.
They drink wine. They're, you know, not in church, but they're not totally against
sure.
that kind of thing. You know, it's what I would call a much more live and let live kind of denomination. But was I totally into it? No, I don't think. I don't really think I was. I mean,
yeah.
I spent, you know, I like to go to church camp a
mm-hmm.
lot, mainly because I was, like, you know, getting away from home for a
yeah.
week. I was, you know, like, you know, meet girls, you know, do, you know, just like, you know, be out there in the, you know, in nature in the summertime. I wasn't really into
yeah.
religion per se. I do remember that. Like, I did go, you know, I did go through a slight phase where I decided I was going to read the Bible.
Yeah.
And I got through a fair amount of it, you know, but where I'm at right now, and where I've been at for a long time is that I'm really anti-organized religion.
Sure.
I mean, what's your stance on things?
Well, I can elaborate on the other podcast, but this one's about you.
Oh, okay.
So.
Okay. Okay. So like, wow, rules. Okay. Well, okay. You know, I'm not a fan of organized religion. I think organized religion is causing a lot of problems in
mm-hmm.
our world right now. And I, and because of where I just come from a philosophical standpoint, I don't, I'm not a man of faith.
Sure.
I have journalism training. I'm more of a man of facts.
Yeah.
Okay. So I hate mathematics, but I love absolutes. So,
yeah.
Okay. So I believe in, you know, like I prefer science over faith.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I just, you know, when people say that they have faith in something, it's, you know, it's because there's no concrete evidence.
Yeah.
And so they've just got to go with the next best thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a really big fan of the next best thing.
Yeah.
If Jesus were to walk in to this studio right now, you know, and then proceeded to heal my stammering or whatever, then I would believe.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, it's hard having that opinion either in Oklahoma, obviously, but then writing for Oklahoma.
Yeah, that is a hard thing, and you know, and so maybe maybe I'll be pilloried for this, after people listen to this podcast. But quite honestly, it is hard. It's hard to live in a very faith-based environment.
Mm-hmm.
And I have members of my family who are extremely faith-based.
Yeah.
Their lives are in the church, and I respect them, and they're wonderful people. But and sometimes we've had some hard discussions about
mm-hmm.
this, and about and especially about my feelings about organized religion. Those conversations are no fun, and when you have to confront the differences that you have with your neighbors, with people in all walks of life, it can be very hard. But there are people who deal with worse issues of being minority and stuff.
Sure.
it's just something that you you learn to be polite.
Yeah.
and to be respectful of other people's beliefs and faiths and what have you.
Yeah.
It's better than being the angry agnostic.
Sure.
Those people spend a lot of alone time.
Yeah. but I mean, you're not trying to like convince people, at least.
No, I have a lot of people in my life who I've found commonality with.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that I tend to necessarily dwell on.
Sure.
It's just that religion gets into a lot of areas that it necessarily shouldn't be in, and it because of the some of the problems that are associated with it, I kind of like just try to not involve myself in it very much. Again, try to be respectful, but that's about where I am, where I'm at.
Yeah. Do you think that people should, if anything, lean more towards the logical side?
I would like to see, a lot of people, they live happy and fulfilled lives, in being people of faith. But when it comes at the expense of understanding our life,
mm-hmm.
and where we came from,
yeah.
The physical realities of being a living group of cells, then that's denying truth.
Yeah.
Okay. And so I believe that you can be a person of faith and yet understand that the world is probably not 6,000 years old.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that you can accept that that there's strong evidence for evolution,
mm-hmm.
And still believe in Jesus Christ, or
sure.
Or in Muhammad, or in Buddha, or
mm-hmm.
whoever.
Yeah. And then a much more difficult question is, and I'm sorry, but
it's fine. It's fine.
Do you believe in free will?
In free will, as opposed to there being fate.
No, as opposed to sort of like determinism,
mm-hmm.
in that. Free will is basically like the choices that we make are up to us,
mm-hmm.
whereas determinism is a bit more like, yeah, you made that decision, but that was predicated on lots of other things that happened to you before, too.
That's a hard question, as you said, but I believe that yes, I don't think that there are necessarily external or supernatural forces,
mm-hmm.
that are directing us in some way. I don't believe that that we are necessarily guided.
Sure.
I do believe that there can be external forces in our society,
mm-hmm.
that can force you to make certain decisions,
yeah.
that you otherwise would not.
Yeah.
That's just basic human reaction to,
yeah.
to your surroundings. but I do believe in free will to some degree.
Sure. And then has your opinion on religion affected how you raise your son?
Yeah. That's an interesting thing, because honestly, I didn't know what I was going to do.
Yeah.
You don't, there's benefits to being, to growing up in churches,
mm-hmm.
Your social situation's pretty good,
mm-hmm.
everything. Which could be
why your parents were like, maybe you should go to church.
maybe. It was, hadn't really thought of it that way,
sure.
but they might have been thinking, the kid maybe needs some friends or something. but with my son, I've spoken frankly with him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't tell him what to believe.
Yeah.
With regard to that, I feel like that's his own journey. Okay?
Yeah.
But when he asks me questions, I don't sugarcoat it necessarily.
Yeah.
Because he has a lot of people who are active members of churches who really love him a lot,
mm-hmm.
and he loves them. And so I don't want to say that what they believe in is wrong ever.
Yeah.
But I'll say this is what I think, which, and so I'll say things like, if he asks me, why I don't go to church, I'll tell him that, that it has, a lot to do with, what, the impact that churches can have on society, which, right now we are seeing all, I see a lot of negatives.
Yeah.
Right now. And, when you see, church groups lobbying for certain, science books to be amended.
Yeah.
And any references to evolution and things like that taken out. I see that as, as society not moving forward in the way that it should, absolutely should.
Yeah.
And so, so I will, I talk to him about those things, and then I'll say, on the same token, churches can do a lot of good things for people.
Yeah.
So, but I don't, but you can't really be didactic with kids if you're the angry agnostic all the time, then, you could end up with a kid who rebels against you and they become Stephen Miller in the Trump administration, who's a child of hippies, living in Santa Monica.
Yeah.
And he becomes this super conservative.
It goes in both directions.
It can. It absolutely can. I'm the child of conservative parents.
Yeah.
And I grew up as a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And I changed my mind. And oddly enough, it was the military that did it.
Yeah.
just from experience. And so you can absolutely swing the other way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want him to have some sort of reaction. It's like, God, my dad was a dick. Why? I don't want to be like that.
Yeah.
God, he never smiled or anything. He was always mad at the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I want him to reach some of his own conclusions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then sort of I mean, when we say things like should, we're sort of making moral statements. So in what ways is should move forward by accepting science or extending rights to other people?
Right.
How did these moral opinions, I guess, change whenever you were changing how you felt politically, and especially through the military.
Yeah, I mean, my mom will say that she always thought that I was a liberal, but I think maybe there was a little bit of fear of what was, what was happening with during the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't, I grew up at a time when you saw it, when you had, these shows on TV, there was this multi-part documentary on CBS when I was about, 14, called The Defense of the United States. that was seriously all about, the Cold War and the possibility of nuclear winter.
Yeah.
And, and they had a, a reenactment or not a reenactment because that hasn't happened, but they showed what it would look like if a nuclear bomb were to go off in Kansas.
Sure.
And, and that freaked my shit out
in
a big way.
Yeah.
And then, it didn't help when not too long after that, there was the ABC series The Day After that came out.
Mm.
And, you know, and that was pretty scary too.
Yeah.
And we were all talking about that in school.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there were some things I was definitely not a, sort of like a hardcore, militant conservative pro proliferation kind of guy. When I was growing up, but I self-identified as a Republican,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and I voted for Reagan for mm-hmm. my first general election. You know, when I got into the military, see, the military can do one of two things. It can make a conservative person more conservative
mm-hmm.
because the culture of the military sort of reinforces conservatism.
Yeah.
You know, or you can see things that you don't really like in it.
Yeah.
And it can kind of turn your head around.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know, so there were a few things. Like I remember you know, I was in you know, during the you know, Iran-Contra scandal, where the, you know, and you know, there were a lot of things that were being done, you know, during that time, and you know, arms for hostages, all of those things, where I felt like this is not right.
Yeah.
And these are things that were being done, you know, with you know, by a political leader that mm-hmm. I had voted for, which I thought, so that was kind of a rough thing to square.
Yeah.
Also there was just this aspect of waste when it came to the military. And I can imagine that a lot of people are going to hear that. And it's like, there's no such thing as waste in the military. You've got to be prepared all the time.
Sure.
You know, but, you know, listen, I was stationed on an aircraft carrier.
Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, we were out of Japan, and we would spend like weeks in the South China Sea off the coast of the Philippines, basically doing donuts in the water, letting planes take off and land, doing
mm-hmm.
training missions, sorties,
mm-hmm.
all of these things, and you know, in and in mid-80s dollars, we're talking about, you know, $1 million a day probably.
Yeah.
to run an aircraft carrier, you know, in full readiness mode.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you take that and then you start multiplying it, you know, and you know, say you spend 3 weeks out there doing that.
Mm-hmm.
There's not, you know, nobody's attacked. You're not attacking anybody.
Yeah.
And it's just training.
Yeah.
You know, and then you consider that at the time we had about a dozen aircraft carriers.
Yeah.
And, you know, and at any given time, a third of them were out there doing the same
yeah.
thing somewhere in the world. Then you realize that a whole shit ton of money is
yeah.
being spent
yeah.
on something where, you know, it's only preparedness. And then you think, but wait a second, and these same people who are really, who are pushing for, you know, for a larger military force and more equipment and
mm-hmm.
more, and more of all this. Well, they're also saying that we shouldn't have social programs that you know, the programs that keep people from
mm-hmm.
falling through the cracks
yeah.
shouldn't be there.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe that kids shouldn't have school lunch programs,
yeah.
or you know, that you know, or that you know, that maybe we should privatize Social Security so
mm-hmm.
that we don't have to spend money on this. And
yeah.
they want to kind of like return us to this sort of like Dickensian world, you know. Just because they don't want to spend X number of millions of dollars,
yeah,
but they're spending it on that,
yeah.
Okay, so I just felt like, you know, holy
yeah.
shit, I am I'm in the wrong place.
Yeah.
I don't, this is not, you know, this shouldn't be my life. You know, and I support the fact that we should have a military,
mm-hmm.
but I feel like that, you know, our priorities are out of whack.
Yeah.
I also had, like, this friend of mine who was, you know, there are quite a few liberals in the military. They
mm-hmm.
just, you know, sometimes people just end up there for whatever reason, you know.
Yeah.
It takes all kinds, really. I remember there was one night when a bunch of us were out drinking like you do in
sure.
the military, and and we were having this sort of like philosophical discussion. He was asking me about all of you know my opinions on different things,
mm-hmm.
whether it was abortion and about my philosophies on, you know, how money should be spent, or all of, you know, just like, it was like a litany of questions.
Yeah.
He says, like, you're the worst conservative I've ever met. and it was really at that time that I kind of like faced up to it. I was like, yeah, I kind of am. Right? and so I started, following through on what I really believed.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, in 1988, back in California, and I'm, you know, and I vote for Dukakis, and, you know, didn't go well, but I was being a little more true to myself,
yeah.
I think, at that point. And, it was a long time in coming, I think.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of, like, whether or not I... sure, let's just... my usual last question is, what advice do you have for people?
In general?
Yeah. Maybe whatever is on your mind that you think people should be advised about, or even just, like, the people that might listen to this, which... I don't even know who my audience is.
I think that all of us would do very, very well to source our opinions well. Okay. Every asshole has an opinion these days.
Mm-hmm.
And I really feel like that we need to be more grounded in facts. We need to be better read.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be paying attention to things that are real. And, you know, coming from a guy who is an entertainment writer, that might that might sound disingenuous, but I've always felt like. We should be looking at things through clear eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, so like, fewer opinions, more facts, surround yourself with knowledge,
mm-hmm.
And not just the knowledge that makes you feel warm and fuzzy, but
yeah.
like, you know, but real things.
Mm-hmm.
We would all be better off if we did that.
Yeah.
I do feel like, you know, I'm an ideologue, but at the same time, I really feel that, knowing the truth rather than just the things that reinforce my opinions about things.
Mm-hmm.
is probably a lot better off.
Yeah.
That applies to, you know, I mean, you know, the things that I read, if I feel like something is just kind of catering to my already beloved set of beliefs, then I'm not that impressed.
Yeah.
I want to be challenged.
Mm-hmm.
We should all be challenged by
the
truth and what's really, really going on in the world.
That's awesome. I appreciate that. Thank you for being a guest on my podcast.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's fun.
Where can we support you or find you or whatever?
Wow. Well, I don't have a GoFundMe or anything like that, though maybe I should. You can read my things over at okgazette.com, mm-hmm. or you can pick up the Oklahoma Gazette on a newsstand. They've got racks everywhere. I am, like I said, every Saturday night on the Spy, I host Spy 101, and I've been doing it for, let's see, a little over 3 months, maybe four months at this point, and it is a blast. I really enjoy it. I pretty much put the thing together myself, and then Ferris O'Brien, our fearless leader over at the Spy, he puts his finishing touches on it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a hell of a lot of fun.
Yeah,
and so go there, and I'm on Twitter at George D. Lang, and that's cool. It.
And if you need PR or something, I don't know.
Oh yeah, reach out to me. I mean, I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. Just reach out.
Yep.
Let me know. But that's a lot of fun for me as well.
Mm-hmm.
I like, all of, the people that I work with are people that I choose to work with.
Yeah.
And that's really rewarding.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you again. I'm Santiago Ramones. I make music. I'm a composer, and you can find all the things that I do on my website, santiagoramones.com, where you will also find this podcast, which I always end with my three things, which are love never fails, it's going to be okay, I might be wrong.